Good morning. After the first case, we're going to have a short break because there will be a slight change in panel, but that won't take long. First case is the United States versus Charles Hausman et al. Who's first? Mr. Albee?
May it please the court, my name is Craig Albee. I represent Dr. Scott Rise in this matter. Dr. Rise stands convicted along with his co-defendant, Charles Hausman, an attorney, of conspiring to commit mail and wire fraud. The charge arises out of a referral arrangement that attorney Hausman and Dr. Rise had, in which attorney Hausman would refer his personal injury clients to Dr. Rise. In exchange, Dr. Rise would write checks to third parties, principally to charities and to support a joint marketing campaign in an amount approximating 20% of the medical bills that Dr. Rise collected. There is no dispute in this case that the clients of Hausman McNally received excellent medical care. And when I say excellent medical care, that encompasses not just the care they received from the chiropractic clinic MSIC, but also there was no overbilling. There were no unnecessary services performed in order to inflate bills. There is no extension of treatment in order to inflate bills. There also is no dispute in this case that the legal services that the clients received from the Hausman McNally firm were also excellent. That is, there's no suggestion here that Hausman McNally did not zealously negotiate with insurance companies to obtain the maximum payout for the clients.
Who is the other doctor along with Rice?
Dr. Smichael is the treating chiropractor for most of the patients referred by Hausman McNally.
Now, as I understand it, he sort of blew the whistle because he thought his bonus was being used to go to these other directions. Right?
That is correct. He believed that MSIC was not profiting to the extent they could, and that was affecting the bonuses that he would receive.
Profiting because of the money that was diverted?
Correct, because Dr. Smichael viewed that money as money that would go into the hands of MSIC and Dr. Rise, and that he would get some of that additional income.
Now, it's also not in dispute that this 20% arrangement wasn't disclosed to the patients.
That is correct.
And so isn't that a problem relating as it relates to your theory here? I understand your position that they got great care and there wasn't overbilling, but isn't that a problem?
I don't believe so. Again, we have argued that there needs to be a showing of at least reasonably foreseeable harm to the clients of Hausman McNally, and that wasn't proven here. There is no showing that this money, this 20%, would have been available for any of the clients were it not written out at the direction of Mr. Hausman for other purposes.
The 20% was paid to make sure that the lawyer referred the case to the doctor, was it?
I would agree with that. To complete the thought as to the lack of harm here, there's just absolutely no showing that these clients would have collected something more. The negotiations between the Hausman McNally firm and the chiropractic clinic, MSIC, were not along the lines of the negotiations between Hausman McNally and the insurance companies, for example. They were not adversaries. They were really teammates in this enterprise. And I think contrary to the suggestion at points in the government's brief, Hausman McNally did not try to maximize the cuts in medical bills and would not have had reason to do that. The billings were fair and reasonable and at customary rates. They were along the lines that other chiropractic firms billed the clients of Hausman McNally. When deemed necessary in order to obtain settlement of a case and to obtain a fair settlement for the clients, in those instances, then MSIC would be asked to take cuts. But there was no effort by Hausman McNally to nickel and dime the clinic in order to maximize the payout to the client in that sense. Certainly one principal issue raised in this case is whether there needs to be proof of reasonably foreseeable harm at the very least. I think this court should clearly adopt such a requirement. It would impose a reasonable limitation, I think, on the scope of Section 1346. It's been adopted in at least six other circuits. It's consistent with what this court held in the Feldman case, which predated McNally. Bloom and other cases reflect that 1346 should not be expanded beyond the scope of the intangible rights doctrine as it existed pre-McNally. And in Feldman, this court held that secret profits alone, the receipt of secret profits alone, would not support an intangible rights claim, and also that where there's a claim non-disclosure, that non-disclosure either does or could result in harm to the alleged victims of the case. And here we don't have that.
Well, the alleged victims in this case are the clients, right?
Yes.
And would you call reasonably foreseeable harm a detriment to the clients as opposed to, I guess, the doctor's office? Because your position, as I understand it, is the clients got exactly what they bargained for.
Absolutely.
And that it is the doctor's office, if anything, that got trimmed, according to Dr. Schmeichel or whatever his name is.
Correct. There is no claim that Dr. Schmeichel was a victim here.
Well, he claimed it.
Well,
didn't he think that this he was doing all the, as I read the brief, he's doing most of the work in this clinic.
That's true. He's a salaried employee for
right.
the clinic.
Right. He's a salaried employee, and he's got this huge volume of people that he's zipping through there, all with good quality. That's undisputed, I guess. But he wasn't getting paid, he thought, enough because his bonus was going out the door to these other entities.
There was
is that what I understand?
I would agree with that.
Your theme is the victims are not the clients. They didn't get any reduction. They got the same paid the same fee for the doctor. They got the one third or two thirds or whatever it is from the settlement and insurance, although they had to pay for the medical. You're saying there's no
true.
Foreseeable harm in this whole arrangement?
None at all. These clients were in the same or better position as they would be with any clinic, any attorney's firm. There was no loss to them as a result of this arrangement. And Dr. Schmeichel wasn't claimed to be a victim by the government in this case. That wasn't a theory in
well,
this case.
That's not the theory. That's why I say the alleged victims are the clients.
Correct. Who are not harmed at all in this matter. And that's where I think this case gets very troubling, is that what we end up with here is imposing criminal liability for simply breaching an ethical provision in a state ethics code.
Well, what
lawyers.
The doctor sent out as a bill was not simply a doctor's bill. It was a doctor's bill plus 20% of that, which went to wherever the lawyer told him to send it.
Well, actually...
Well, either he was overcharging for his medical, or if he wasn't overcharging for the medical bill, why was he sending the money back at all? Why was he willing to work at the short dollar?
They were not overcharging. As Dr. Schmeichel indicated, who certainly was no friend of the chiropractic clinic and Dr. Rise at the time of trial, the rates were customary and average and the same as they billed for anyone else.
Rates are negotiable, are they not? I mean, there'd be an antitrust violation if all the doctors charged exactly the same and entered into such an agreement.
But these were the same rates as
other people.
Anyone else was charged.
So far as the evidence is. But if they were going to negotiate in order to get the business, why wouldn't the client benefit instead of the lawyer?
Well,
they did the work on the client, and he was the person who paid the money because it came out of his share of the settlement. Why wouldn't that be rightfully the client's money then?
Dr. Rise is entitled to keep that profit for himself.
I understand what you're saying, but you're not paying attention to what I'm saying. If they are going to reduce the amount of money they're going to charge the patient by 20% so they can pay reduce it by giving that 20% to the lawyer, why wouldn't they have given it to the client if the client could negotiate for that lower figure all by himself and save 20% and make it?
There would be no motivation for for the lawyer to return it to the client.
Well, if the client gets to go or not go to the chiropractor if he wants to, doesn't he? I mean, the lawyer says go to the chiropractor, but the client can say, I can work out a better deal with this chiropractor and make more money.
Well, there's no evidence that there would be a better deal with another chiropractor. I think
As a matter of theory, they had the right to negotiate. As a matter of fact, they had the right to negotiate for any chiropractor they wanted. They didn't have to go to the one the lawyer sent them to.
Absolutely.
Well, when the lawyer sent them to him, they assumed that he was charging the proper fee because it comes out of their share, the client's share, right?
I mean, the client pays the bill, true.
So it comes out of his share of the settlement, the 20%.
Yes.
Instead of going back to the patient, then it goes to the lawyer. And the patient is not told that that 20% doesn't come out of his. It comes out of his, it goes to somebody else.
I think that's factually true, but as a practical matter, that money would never have gone back to the client. The motivation for sending it back to the Houseman McNally is to maintain a referral stream of cases.
That's right. It might have gone back by a reduction of the cost if the patient were smart enough to negotiate a reduction of the charges himself, as the lawyer did, except he kept the profit.
I don't believe, because I think that gets into the volume of cases referred is the motivation.
This is reasonable foreseeability. You know, you're arguing that the government didn't establish a contemplated harm to the victim, but in the Fernandez case, didn't we reject that argument? So how do you get around Fernandez?
I believe Fernandez should be restricted to public sector fraud cases. This court does not need to overrule Fernandez in order to recognize a reasonable foreseeability requirement in private sector cases. And based on the reasoning we've included in the other circuits, I think that's an appropriate requirement to enact in private sector fraud cases.
Okay. Who's next? Mr. Houseman?
Judge, Your Honors, I'm Charles Houseman. I'm the defendant and also the appellant. And I'd like to start at the end and work my way up to the beginning, and I think this answers a lot of the questions you were asking before. One of the things I'm objecting to is that the circuit court decided that there was a 6-level increase for loss to a client, and that there was a 2-level increase because of there was one or more victims. And I think if you take a look at Exhibit H that was submitted as part of this appeal, what happened in this case was that, and loss is defined as pecuniary loss in the loss section of the statute. In other words, there has to be money loss, I think what Judge Bauer was directing ourselves to here. So the question is, under the statute, first of all, is there any loss? And actual loss means the reasonable foreseeable pecuniary harm that resulted from the offense, and it's readily measurable by money. And the victim is any person who sustained a part of that monetary loss. Judge Clavert ruled as follows, and this is in the sentencing transcript at page 53, H, appellate 5. And this is his exact ruling. There's nothing in this record which would support a conclusion that the bills were not reasonable. There's nothing in this record to support the conclusion that the bills were not fair in terms of the general marketplace, and there's nothing in the record to support the conclusion that the services were not provided as consideration for what was to be paid. So I think starting out point that if we go to the loss definition of the sentencing guidelines, there was no loss. These people got what they paid for. But there's another section of the sentencing guidelines that says that there's a credit against loss, and when you calculate credit against loss, the definition is money returned and the fair market value of the property returned and the services rendered by the defendant or other persons acting jointly with the defendant to the victim before the offense was detected. So in other words, we start out with reasonable bills. Then we take a look at I think it was yourself, Judge Bauer, in the Bloom case that talked about that these cases are contract cases, that the lawyer relationship is governed by contract. Our contract provided that we were entitled to one-third of the total recovery, and the doctor was entitled to be paid his medical bills.
Out of
the client's two-thirds. And that was the
contract. You got a piece of that action back.
Well, yes and no.
Like being a little pregnant. Either you are or you aren't.
No.
You got or you didn't.
Well, if you take a look at Exhibit H, we did not, if we're entitled to, this goes under the Bloom definition, and I think this goes to Judge Williams' question, is where we forsake this argument about harm. Let's talk about what Bloom says then, and Bloom says that that the misuse of a fiduciary position for private gain. Gain means that I get something more than I'm entitled to.
Right.
Would you agree? If I'm entitled to a full third of the recovery, and a full third, and the contract, even in the indictment that the government read, I'm entitled to a third of the total compensation in these cases, and the doctor's entitled to his medical fees. I did not take compensation for a third of the attorney's fees.
You're missing something. The client's entitled to two-thirds less what was paid the doctor.
Correct.
The doctor was paid 80% of his bill, not 100%.
The doctor wasn't paid 100% of his bill, but he wasn't paid 80% of his bill. He was paid less than 60% of his bill. Because you have to take a look at the...
Whatever it is, 20% of his bill went to you.
No, because 20%, you're missing, I think, the financial... You're saying... And I don't agree with what counsel said. If you take a look at this relationship in comparison to any other indictment in the history of the Seventh Circuit, there is no case that you can find that a defendant and a fraudulent perpetrator got less money by not enforcing his contract by 300% than he would have if he would have not participated in the fraud. Because these numbers show that we did not take fees of $102,000 we could have taken on car damages. We cut our fees by $20,000+ of the third we could have taken. The doctor reduced his bills another $83,000. He got the benefit of $35,000 of not...
Overall.
That's $238,000 that we would have made if we just would have been according to the contract. So I think that what the section of Bloom that I'm trying to get across to the court and emphasize is that Bloom says we have to have gain. We didn't gain. We took an absolute loss. And that...
Well, that's a fascinating way of looking at it. You could have done better if you'd been honest, is what you're saying.
Well, Judge, I think that... Can you infer that there was intent to defraud...
Sure,
and that there was a private gain in this situation.
You didn't tell anybody about it. He didn't tell his client, his partner about it. You didn't tell your client about it. The whole thing was very secret. Why?
Because
it's legit. Why are we not
putting... Because we weren't hurting anybody. We weren't trying to harm anyone.
Academically, why was it such a big secret? Why are we keeping it a secret?
Judge, I agree with you that in the perfect world, and if I could go back in hindsight and relive a chapter of my life, I would have had that... simple little conflict statement sign that says, you are entitled to know that I have a business relationship with this doctor that will charge you lower than rates. Most of these people didn't have insurance. Your bills will not have to be paid if, the case doesn't pan out, and we will be able to reduce your bills, and I will waive fees on $238,000 worth of materials. I agree with you. That was...
So I recall correctly that you entered a plea of guilty to this.
Yes, I did, according to what the court ruled in the bottom on the circuit court of what constituted fraud.
There must have been some doubt in your mind about the legitimacy of the hold I occupy. Okay, never mind. You've eaten up enough of your time.
Okay. Mr. Skubit.
Thank you. May it please the court, for the government, United States Attorney Stephen Biskupic. First, on the factual matter of the client being hurt, you have to look at the context of this lawyer-client relationship. We have a personal injury case. The client is seeking the lawyer's help to get money, a personal injury settlement, and so the lawyer is being hired to obtain the best possible
money. No, we know all that. Show me where the client got hurt.
Okay. you hire a lawyer to negotiate, because it's not just that the money is going to esoterically exist.
We've already made that point. What did the client lose?
The client lost that 20%, the ability to make a decision with that 20%. You hire an agent to negotiate a contract. The agent goes in and he's taking money under the table, secretly. Now, if it's a sports contract, say $3 million, and the agent's taking $100,000, we know, of course, from the $100,000, or in this case the 20%, that the party on the other side would have parted with that money. They were economically prepared to part with that money. And so the loyalty of the lawyer is lost for the client in an area in which there is a fiduciary relationship. In many ways,
the relationship would not be criminal. For instance, if let's just take this relationship. Suppose that the Hausman firm and the Rise firm, that Hausman provides a lot of volume over there.
Correct.
In return, Dr. Rise has season tickets someplace that are very valuable. And he allows the Hausman firm to use those. And, you know, that comes out, let's say, I don't even want to go to the scalping market, but whatever,
right.
But let's say it's worth $1,000. Is that a kickback?
Well, in the context, my answer would be no. Because, first of all, it's separate from the 20% here.
Let's Rise pays for those tickets somehow or other. Assume he takes that from a profit from his business.
Same way Dr. Rise pays for marketing or advertisement
or
a nice-looking office.
Or the
good
kickback
way.
We have
sure.
here.
And so Bloom tells us you have to have that fiduciary relationship, but then a misuse of that relationship. And in this case, I would suggest to you that we are, no matter what test you want to adopt from any of the circuits that have taken issue with Bloom or not, we're in the middle. In this case, I think the propriety of the government's charge can be seen by staying at 1341 and 1343, just the basic language. What is a fraud in general? A course of conduct intended to deceive in order to obtain something of value. We always look at the context. We always look at the surrounding circumstance. 1346 tells us that it can be a fiduciary relationship going to loyal and honest services. And so in the context here, when a lawyer is hired to negotiate the best possible deal, and yet an explicit part of that deal, not tickets later, not sharing office space, a 20% off the top was agreed to before a client even walked into the office. That was the pattern. It was in cement. And so if you as the client went in, it wasn't like, okay, later on some of your money may be used for Brewer tickets or Green Bay Packer tickets. It was money coming directly out of your share of the settlement. And so it is a direct misuse of your fiduciary relationship, not some abstract principle later. That was your money, that pool of money that you hired an expert to obtain the best possible share. And that is the harm. And that's the test.
I guess this means that I don't know what the volume of clients, I understand that about two-thirds of them were Hausman referrals over to Rise, is that right?
Correct.
So one-third of these people supposedly that were not those referrals got charged at, I don't know what, to say $40 or something for an office call. And then supposedly these particular people got charged $40 for an office call. But because of the volume presented, they were willing to, we'll call it kickback or a refund or any word you want to use. Kickback is the one they used, I guess. So that means this reduction, because of the volume and this arrangement that they have, you say that should have gone to the client and not the client should have been able to pay less for those same services because of their relationship.
Right.
Which would not have existed, I assume, if there were. I mean, what's the incentive to send all your cases over there?
Right. I mean, certainly good care would be one point. Of course,
I'm sure there are several good chiropractors
right.
that could do whatever they did.
Judge, here's the point about the fees, the bills, and the exhibit that Mr. Hausman refers to. It's like the sticker price of a car. It's innegotiable in 85% of these personal injury cases, according to the record that was developed at trial. And so to say we gave reductions, is to ignore that people act in their economic interest and that the chiropractor was showing that he was willing to go down 20% further. Remember, in these personal injury
20% down should have gone to the client, not to the lawyer.
Certainly should have been available.
I understand your theory.
Yeah. And one other point on that is that If you assume that people act rationally in their economic self-interest, at some point, Dr. Rise would have been willing to go further in this pool. Now, it's true, though.
If people acted rationally, men would have ridden side saddle, not women.
How about economically rational?
All right.
In a personal injury case, there's lots of factors that go into settlement. In fact, sometimes no recovery. And so you may have comparative liability. You may have, you know, a tough negotiator on the other side. And so to say in an individual case, the reason the government charged us under 1346 primarily is because in an individual case, it's almost virtually impossible to pull out and say how much money extra that client would have gotten. But in the universe of these cases, of the 200 and some a year and the $300,000 that was at stake in these billings, you can certainly infer, and which the district court did, the magistrate judge, the district judge, and the jury, that the clients were being harmed by this conduct, that money was, you know, for the client.
What if they went to a lawyer who didn't have this arrangement and they said, all right, you got to get medical, so they go over to the same chiropractor and they have the same contract for one-third and the client gets serviced and the bill comes out, it's all the same. Everything's the same, only they don't have this arrangement. That client that picked a different lawyer comes out the same as the one that picked housing. Now, that's where I guess I'm still a little bit perplexed.
Maybe that's because
I didn't write side saddle. I don't know. But whatever it is, it seems that when you focus strictly on the client, arguably in the general marketplace, the client came out the same. Except for this arrangement, which was based on volume and referrals
and all that
sort of thing, which could mean there could be a lot of nefarious activity in that process. But that's not before us.
Well,
everything seems to be on the up and up with the lawyer doing good work with the insurance company, the doctor doing good work with the treatment.
But the lawyer's work is not just with the insurance company.
I know.
It's with the negotiation over the medical bill, too.
If it had been any other place, it would have been the same result.
Well, Judge, going back to my sports analogy, if another agent had negotiated on behalf of the superstar, it's very, very difficult.
How much do they leave on the table?
Yeah. So
that's always the case in any trial.
And
some lawyers are afraid to go to trial.
Right. And isn't that the reason for 1346? Isn't that the reason for the test of loyal and honest services? How about the employee? Let's take Montaney. Montaney and Bloom were two cases decided well before this case, and the government, you know, read those cases, relied upon the test in this indictment. In Montaney, Sears hires somebody to get rid of furniture, excess furniture. The guy knows that he can get extra money on the deal, but goes back to Sears and says, well, I can get you 10 cents on the dollar. Sears is happy with that amount. They thought they were going to have to junk the furniture. Turned out the guy could get 30 cents on the dollar. Now, Sears was happy, not knowing that this arrangement had existed. Yet this court...
That's why Smolka wasn't happy.
Pardon me?
That's why what's his name?
Smichael.
Smichael wasn't happy because, in effect, the Sears didn't get what he thought he should get.
Right.
But that's different than the person who bought the furniture.
Well, Smichael's economic impact on this case was secondary. His bonus, which he thought was being shortchanged because the firm wasn't bringing in the chiropractor firm, that's his motivation to blow the whistle. But in the end, the crafting of the indictment, the proof at trial, is the clients. And we put on clients at trial. We marched a few of them up there. Of course, Mr. McNally, Mr. Hausman's partner, said, first of all, lawyers will get you more money as part of a personal injury case. That fact was undisputed. Second, I never knew, as Mr. Hausman's law partner, that this arrangement existed. So this financial dealing, which, as defense counsel points out, you know, led to money being paid to charity and marketing, but also to landscaping in the backyard of the defendant as well. I mean,
that is a separate charge. That's probably income tax evasion, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly showing gain, improper gain, which is the test under Bloom in 1346. And so Dr. Smichael's interest was not just that he wasn't getting money. He testified he was bothered by this. I mean, the government presented this case as just a classic kickback case. You can go back to all the cases in this circuit over decades. Kickbacks have been a proper theory of criminal prosecution. And so,
does private versus public mean anything?
Sure, because of the fiduciary relationship. But I suggest to you, what is the strongest possible private fiduciary relationship? Isn't that attorney-client? especially when that is negotiated money. If you're going to have any type of private fiduciary relationship covered under the fraud statutes, wouldn't the lawyer relationship be the strongest? And again, going back to a non-fiduciary charge, a regular investment fraud under 1341 and 1343, this court has continually said, judge the facts and circumstances, the honesty. It goes to the deceit. If you're giving money to a broker, and that broker is embezzling your money or wasting it in Las Vegas, we're going to uphold that conviction and not a conviction on a lawyer? I suggest to you that it's almost as strong as the public official. 1346 was clearly passed in mind for public officials, corrupt public officials. But the Congress certainly knew that there were a long line of cases on private fiduciary relationship as well when they passed 1346. So, yeah, I'm not saying that there isn't a great academic debate about where we are on the edges of 1346. This court has had them, the other circuits have had them. But I suggest to you that the lawyer relationship that's at issue here is not close to those edges at all, no matter what circuit you look at, no matter what test you look at. Unless there's any other questions, I would waive the rest of my time.
Fine, thank you. Mr. Albee, do you have something? You just got about a minute.
I'd like to quickly return to a question posed by Judge Bauer. It costs money to generate business for a chiropractic clinic like most other businesses, and MSIC budgeted money to Houseman McNally that could have been budgeted to Yellow Page advertisements or something else. And that's why that money was not available to clients but would have been available to Houseman McNally. It was the cost of doing business necessary to generate business for the clinic. On another point, Mr. Biskupic referred to this case as a classic kickback or something like that. In the classic honest services cases, what is going on is that somebody is being paid not to do their job. That is not what is taking place here.
It's not necessarily a classic kickback. Kicking back is you can have an employee that works for you, but he's required to kick back 3% or 5%. But he works full-time, does a good job, and everything else. Not being paid not to work, he's being paid, and then he pays you back for the job.
He's being paid not to do his job in the diligent fashion he otherwise would. I mean, I take a case like George, for example, where the purchasing...
Can't you contemplate hiring somebody, paying him a full salary, have him work full-time, but the only condition is he give you a piece of the action under the table? A kickback scheme.
I mean, I don't think there's a deprivation of honest services unless there's something that person's not doing in their employment that they otherwise would be. Mm-hmm. I don't think that exists.
Okay, thanks. How much time? About 1 minute to finish up, Mr. Houseman, if you had something more.
Mr. Houseman.
I just would like to say one thing, Your
Honor. Okay, come up here and say it. You've got to say it in the microphone. Wait. Do you get here?
Excuse me. I think that the court is missing one point, and I'd just like the court, I know that Judge Bauer's questions seem to imply that this is very much of a skullduggery situation. I would ask the court to take a look at the record, that this 20%, although it maybe is arguably what I think I'm hearing is that it's the client's money, I firmly believed that it was Dr. Rise's money. If you take a look where that money was going not into my pocket, subject to this argument about this few plants that are an issue, but there was hundreds of thousands of dollars that went to develop a marketing program for chiropractors. And there was money that went to develop what I consider good public projects in the inner city of Milwaukee for a park and for free health care to people that couldn't afford it. Now, I think that if you take a look at where the money went, was that a legitimate business expenditure of Dr. Rise's money? And the argument is, I think it was.
Okay, thanks. This case will be taken under advisement, and as I said earlier, we'll take a short recess. We'll be back in a few minutes.